folks, and welcome one more time to the Watcher podcast. This is episode 10. I am Connor, and this is Fan.
Hey, everybody.
Welcome music. Let's talk about that as usual. This was made by our friend U235 of Luscious 235. Their debut album, Endgame. You can catch that. There'll be a link to it on my website, and also we'll put it up on Twitter. It's available on stream platforms, but you can also purchase it, which I think you should do. Also, the vinyl comes out very, very soon, so you should pick that up. Again, check the links and stuff, and you'll see when. All month, we've been giving a shout-out to Lance Cooper. He is at Escaped Matrix on Twitter, and he's behind the Save Flint Challenge. Now, if you've been following, or you know, if you've seen him on Twitter, you probably know about this. They've done a great deal, actually, to provide clean water in Flint, and they've got goals to actually help with the infrastructure. But Lance has a new project as well. The Captain Marvel Challenge, and it's inspired by this new movie that's coming out, and it's about inspiring young women, and it's about film. So take a look. It's pretty exciting. I don't want to say too much about it, but go to his Twitter and check it out. Also, we'll put a link to it in our in one of our tweets that we put out, I guess. But yeah, do check that out. That's gonna be really exciting. So what is the third leg of the tripod?
I have a question for you first, Connor.
Yeah, go ahead.
You told us to go to your website, but you didn't tell us what it was.
Yeah, I do that all the time. All the time. Okay, so yeah, I do voiceovers for a living. And we put our podcast through my website because that was like the easiest way to do it. My website is connorvoice.com, the old Irish spelling, so it's C-O-N-O-R. Connorvoice.com, and go to podcast. You can find it there. That's also something that you might recommend to any friend who's has trouble getting onto iTunes or whatever Android app that they use. Let them know that you can actually listen directly on that website as well. I should probably mention that every week. Thank you, Fan.
For sure. And you can download it too if you're the kind of person that prefers to download a podcast. There's a couple of you out there that have talked to me over the last few weeks that you can download from Connor's website as well.
Yeah, you can just save the file. No problem. Yeah.
Yeah, no problem. And they're small, too, so you don't even need a lot of hard drive space.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Three legs of Republican support, right?
So what are the three, and what is number three?
The three are the social conservative base, which we talked about a couple of episodes ago. Uh-huh. The second leg, in my opinion, would be the fiscal conservative base, which we talked about in the last episode. Uh-huh. And the third leg would be the newest of the – well, no, actually, I wouldn't say the newest, but the maybe the most dominant of the three wings – the three legs, maybe the biggest of the three legs, the foreign interventionist wings.
Okay.
Foreign interventionist wing. Well, that was hard to pump out quick.
Yeah, that's actually a tricky one to say.
That was a tricky one to say. These are the people that a lot of people like to refer to as the neocons, the neoconservatives. And there's a very specific reason they're called neoconservatives, because they're not all the way conservative. And to explain that, we just have to get a little bit into liberalism, Connor.
All right. So this is a good one, because when we first started talking a lot about politics, before we started doing a show, one of the things that I was always – like the question that I was always dancing around the edge of is, yeah, but no, but what the fuck are neocons? So here we are.
They're a small yet dominant sect of the Republican support base, I'd say. More so now that they've been around and dominant since probably the 80s, I'd say. Yet another gift from Reagan was that there were plenty of neocons in his administration. To understand what a neocon is, you have to understand just a little bit of the basics of liberalism. And there's kind of two dichotomous thoughts in what we would call classic liberalism. And it's the struggle between community and government intervention versus individualism and property rights. These two concepts are opposed to each other. It's one of the reasons that Dems have so much trouble, is because there is the individualism married with community spirit in the Democratic Party. It's a lot of times why they say they're herding cats, I think, is because they have a wide, wide range of philosophies to fit into the classic liberal mold.
That makes sense.
So if we take those two concepts of the two general basic philosophies of what liberalism is, And if we look at the individualism and property rights aspect of it, these were the guys who in the 60s were liberal Democrats like Bill Kristol, they were probably more on the social conservative side. So they may have been inclined to rebel against the Cultural Revolution that was going on in the 60s. And they were more inclined to rebel against the hard, hard left communists that were in the liberal side of politics at the time. Which meant, of course, they were going to not like the communists that were coming from the Soviet Union. But nobody did at the time, really.
Right.
Well, what separated a neocon was that they felt that a stronger military policy against the Soviets was more appropriate than economic sanctions what they would call appeasement. Mostly the Democrats at the time had a policy of containment.
And what form did that take?
Just making alliances, kind of what we do now, with China. Actually, we try to make alliances that are not advantageous to China with its neighbors.
Okay.
Whether that would be a treaty or a trade agreement or something like that. More now trade agreements. But back then it was treaties, non-aggression pacts and things like that. You would try to make allies out of all the people that surround a communist bloc so that you knew you had a buffer, really in a self-preservation way. They would kind of have to come through your allies before they came to you,
Right.
But it was before NATO, so there was – well, actually, it was during NATO. So there was, the North Atlantic Treaty. The North Atlantic Treaty. I mean, that's exactly what that is. That's, hey, you guys are right there. We'll come and back you if something happens,
Right.
And that's containment. NATO – the reason that the NATO-driven worked is – when you think about it, the 60s Democrats were proven correct in that the non-aggression did work better up until now. I think that we lost sight of it. But – it was working better than war was. Vietnam didn't really work out so well, neither did Korea, mm-hmm. It was the same for the Soviets too, though. Afghanistan didn't work out real well for them either. So
no,
and you're always in danger if you're going into a country if two nations are fighting over one nation, it's usually not going to end well.
Yeah.
Generally speaking, and the rule of thumb is don't get involved in a land war in Asia, which is, strictly speaking, pretty damn good advice.
Yeah, it really is. It holds up.
Yeah, it has held up for a long, long time. Alexander the Great found out, It's held up for a long, long time. The only person that really proved that wrong was Genghis Khan, I guess, when you think about it. But he just took over Asia, so,
Yeah, he's kind of a steamroller.
Yeah, they were steamrollers. They definitely were. They were a long way ahead of their time, militarily speaking. But that's neither here nor there. We're talking about the neocons. And so, they rebelled against the what was going on in the Democratic Party. They rebelled against the peace movement and the, free love movement and all that stuff because they were a little more cultural conservative. And they found themselves a home in the Republican Party, which, interestingly, had kind of been an isolationist party until the years of Vietnam, when the Republican Party really went all in on fighting communism, I don't know the details of that. I just know that that's around the time that they decided that they weren't really an isolationist party anymore.
Yeah.
I have a feeling that it's mostly because it was a cultural thing. Most of the young people, the young baby boomers that were identifying as Democrats that were in the peace movement. And the Democratic Party itself was a little more peace movement oriented at the time than the Republicans were. So the neocons, they found a fit there, and they found a good one too, because not only does the individualism concept run real strong in the Republican Party, the fallacy of pulling yourself up by your own bootstraps, yeah, been on that one a little bit lately, because I don't know. For another episode.
Yeah. Yeah.
but they also, property rights is something that, the Republican Party is really, really, really hot on. They love the concept of property rights, which is why the eminent domain debate and putting Trump's wall up became so interesting to me, because this is a party that personal property rights are paramount. That's a corporate thing, you know, and that's why the corporate. Sorry, I almost went off on corporations. That's why Cummings found a good fit there, because they were about these personal property rights. And if you remember, this was the time, you know, the Mad Men time or whatever, when corporations were really starting to hit their stride in America, you know, post-industrial revolution. After the Gilded Age tamp down, corporations were starting to hit their stride again, you know. And yeah, even though there were high taxes and a lot of regulations and stuff, they still felt that there was a lot of opportunity in America. And these neocons shifted over to the Republican Party and found themselves some war corporations that were very, very willing to play this game, as Eisenhower liked to call it, the military-industrial complex. And as odd as it may seem, the advent of the military-industrial complex is really the advent of the megacorporation in America and a lot of how it does business, until the 80s when some Japanese influences came in. But generally speaking, the same formulas that the United States Army uses for logistics are the same that were created for the United States Army are the same formulas that corporations used at the time for logistics, and probably up until the 80s.
That's really interesting.
So what you have is, and keep in mind, it's a natural thing too. You had a lot of veterans coming back from World War II. They went right into the private sector. They brought their ways of doing things with them.
Yeah.
So what you end up with is a burgeoning militarized business environment. Fair enough?
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is supported by a party who believes that in the most ridiculous, peace through strength, which just means go fight war.
Yeah.
Like, it's not really peace through strength if you're using the strength to fight war.
Yeah, it's not like a Kane and Kung Fu peace through strength vibe.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like, there's a difference between intimidating someone and kicking their ass.
Yeah.
So this is grand. This is perfect for the Republican Party. They're marrying themselves with business. They're marrying themselves with business, right? They've created another grand lie, peace through strength.
Yeah.
That lie is so grand that Trump used it to get elected. He didn't say peace through strength because he ain't fucking smart enough to know what those people were saying, right? But he did say things like, I want our military to be so strong and tough, or whatever the stupid superlatives that he used were.
Beautiful.
That Trump would even mess with us, you know?
Yeah.
Now, here's the thing, though. The other place I wanted to go with this is, in the end of the last episode, I said, here's the thing, that Trump broke the party by breaking a leg. He broke the foreign interventionist leg.
Okay, let's talk about that.
That's an easy sell, my friend. No, it really is. He's pulling out of Syria, and he's pulling out of Afghanistan. Those are cash cows, baby. Maybe not Syria so much, although bombs cost a hell of a lot of money, and they're not spending a lot of money there other than paying for bombs and fuel and stuff, you know?
Yeah.
And the tech to keep the planes going. But Afghanistan, there's still a lot of money being made there. Iraq, there was a ton of money made off the government on that. A ton. Yemen, I feel confident that I'm able to tell this without it being a secret, but the operators that I've known throughout the course of my life since the beginning of the Iraq war have told me that the place that we should be fighting is Yemen.
Really?
How fascinating is that?
It's pretty fucking fascinating, to be honest.
Because that's where the bad guys are.
Wow.
Now, this is from the people who I know that were in that fight, that were in the briefing rooms, you know?
Yeah.
And this is old information, and I usually don't think it's really not, like, I think that more people know it than I would suspect, you know?
Yeah.
But when Trump came to power, one of the things he, well, before Trump came to power, when he was campaigning, one of the things that he said often was, is that he thought the Iraq war was a mistake. Remember?
Yeah. Yeah.
He sold that to the Republican base. Why was he able to do that? Because they've been lying to their base for so long, they finally felt like somebody was telling them the truth. Because the Republican base has just as many people who join the military as the Democrat base. And that's the truth. It just affects them more because they're in smaller towns. If 50 people from the city of Chicago join the military, that's a drop in the bucket. But if 50 people from BFE, Wisconsin join the military, you know, that's what, half their 20-something-year-old population.
Right.
So it affects them more, you know? Like, in general, like, that's a loss of their economic status. That's another lost person. Family, if that person comes home and he's in trouble, then it affects the city and the state. And so this foreign intervention, I'm just going with that. All right. This foreign intervention policy has been a bane on the Republican base as well. So it was an easy sell for Trump to say, hey, I'm not taking you to war anymore. Now, whether or not that was, you know, a Putin-oriented decision, that's for another show. That's not what we're talking about.
Right.
We are talking about is that there were three legs in that tripod and Trump kicked one of them out. A big, fat cash cow one, too.
Wow. And what is it our buddy Frank Herbert said about tripods?
It is the most unstable of political organizations.
And that's why.
If you're sitting on a stool with three legs and somebody kicks one out, you're going down.
Mm-hmm.
And the party was on this precipice before, too. When Bush took the nation to war on lies to Iraq, this costly, terrible humanitarian disaster of a war, man, you know?
Yeah.
And that's, I think, when it started to hit the Republican base, because that's when 50 kids from BFE, Wisconsin joined because of 9/11. And they were told that Iraq was responsible for 9/11 in some fashion, harbored the terrorists, had weapons of mass destruction, just couldn't be allowed to survive as a nation, right? Sure.
Yeah.
Here's the secret of that. You want to know the secret of that? When Bill Clinton was president, the neocons, to include Dick Cheney himself, Donald Rumsfeld himself, Bill Kristol, and a couple of other the fancy dudes that think they know more than us, wrote a nice long letter to Bill Clinton that they should do exactly what George W. Bush did when he became president.
Waiting for somebody to pick it up and put it into use for really a while.
Yeah. They didn't want that oil. They didn't want Saddam in charge of oil anymore. And they knew if we swept in, we could sweep in corporations behind them, you know, individual property rights, right? We could sweep in corporations behind them to buy up the oil in different places all around and then sell it to the Iraqi people or process it for the Iraqi people or in some fashion roll in there and make a lot of money. And they told Bill Clinton that's what they wanted to do, and he refused to do it.
Wow.
So when George W. Bush came there, they just executed the plan, man.
Yeah. He was a little more pliable.
Quite a bit more pliable, I would have to say.
Yeah.
I've heard wonderful things about this movie, Vice, and I'm dying to see it because Dick Cheney maybe even more so than Newt Gingrich, is my freaking nemesis, man.
It looks amazing. Yeah, I'm excited about it, actually. Maybe, you know, we could treat ourselves and do like a one-off, you know, just talking about a movie episode. Yeah.
Let's do that sometime. That would be fun. Yeah. I've often thought how we would lose every listener we ever had if we did like a D&D or a video game episode or something.
I know. But this one we might get away with. Folks, if you're listening, please don't tell our listeners.
So, I mean, going back to it though, and you know, but that, like, that behavior from the intervention wing, the foreign intervention wing, uh-huh. It's not new. I mean, when we talked about it before, when Reagan was president, Dick Cheney himself wrote this big old falsified brief about a sonar proof sub that the Soviets had developed that we just had to spend trillions of dollars to beat, you know?
Yeah.
And it was a lie. The whole thing was a lie, you know?
The audacity.
The audacity to lie, right? And
yeah.
And well, dude, you know, I know you like to talk about norms. I've noticed that, and I do too.
Yeah.
And that one of the norms that is unfortunately being broken for a lot of my citizenry, my fellow citizenry, is the tolerance for lies. But I think that the tolerance for lies was there a long time. People just weren't lying so bald-facedly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, did you know that we have an act in our government? This is real. I can't believe I never heard of this. There's an actual congressional act that executive agencies must tell the truth based on science, facts, and studies, or they can be sanctioned by our own government and forced to rewrite reports.
Does anyone know about this?
Like, I just read about it like 2 days ago. It's not even an old law either. It's from like the 70s or the 80s. I don't think it's that old.
It seems like a forgotten law.
Well, you have to remember that we generally had an honest government in Obama, yeah. Generally, you know, and that the first 2 years of the Trump presidency was sycophancy from the, you know, from the congressional branch.
Right.
I mean, it really was. Somebody said the other day that I think it was Joy Reid. She said Nancy Pelosi had used the power of the speakership, which is something we haven't seen in a long time. And that's true. We haven't seen the power of the speakership since before John Boehner. John Boehner was a very weak speaker. What the Republicans never tell people, and I don't understand why the Democrats don't scream this from the wings all the time. What the Republicans never tell people is that all those years that John Boehner was the speaker and Paul Ryan was the speaker, they couldn't have passed anything without 40 or 50 Democrats every single time.
Really?
Yeah. The Freedom Caucus, they wouldn't vote with Republicans. The fiscal conservative Tea Party guys, they were just full-out obstructionists. You know, they wouldn't vote for anything they didn't like, of which Mick Mulvaney was one of those guys, by the way. He was one of those guys pushing Congress in that direction from Congress. Why do they never say that? Why does Paul Ryan never say, I passed so many bipartisan bills? Because it's toxic.
Right.
Because they've been telling the social conservative base, Democrats are evil. So you can't tell them that they've been getting all your stuff through.
Yeah.
So here we are, right? We got Trump pulling out of Syria. We got Trump pulling out of Afghanistan haphazardly too, which I don't know. He does everything haphazardly. But you have a bedrock of support in the Republican Party that has been based on making money through war since the 60s, since Vietnam, man. Right. You know?
Right. And doesn't have to make money for certain people to make money anyway.
Right. If the right people are making money, it doesn't matter how it's being made.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
That's obscene, but it's true.
Yeah. So it's not just the profitable wars that are profitable.
You don't even have to win a war to make money if you're a military contractor.
Absolutely.
America wins the war or not. You still sold bombs.
Yeah.
You still had to replace, what, 35 F-16 fighters?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, what do you care? So, of course, you're in bed with these Republicans. Of course you are. Because they want to use your stuff and pay for your contracts and on and on and on, you know?
Yeah.
Well, what happens if you get a leader of a party who decides they're not going to do that anymore? That we're not going to spend money to buff up NATO anymore. Like, the reason nobody cared that NATO, that Germany wasn't paying 2% of its GDP, that it was only paying 1.5%, is because the people that were making money were still making money. They didn't care that America was covering that extra 0.5%. These are not real numbers, by the way, folks. Those are not, those are example numbers, okay?
Yeah.
But, you know, Boeing doesn't care that the money comes from America, because realistically, it probably does in the long run anyway, because we subsidize a lot of that. So you have this machine in the Republican Party that's keeping these policies afloat that are keeping corporations afloat. It's an indirect corporate welfare.
Oh, yeah.
So then, because you have guys like the fiscal conservatives that think the private sector does everything better than the public sector, and you have these war hawks who think that we should constantly be at war and we need to funnel that money to the people who built the things for our war, the World War II lesson, then it's natural, again, that some guy that was in charge of Boeing would suddenly be the department, you know, the Secretary of Defense. That's a natural progression.
Yeah.
In the war of modern Republican philosophy. Right?
Yeah. I'm sorry. I just went quiet there because I was just thinking about it. It's really interesting how it all comes together, because when you look at, say, the tripod, as we've been talking about, and invading a country, you can see how all three parts of the tripod could easily have been sold on it, right? Like the social conservatives, it's easy to say to them, well, like, they're basically, they're infidels. I mean, whatever, we use a different word, but essentially they're bad.
Easy to see sell.
Yeah. That's really interesting.
To the point of soldiers were writing infidel on their rifles.
Yeah.
You know, so you can sell the war. If you're the neocon, you can sell the war to your conservative base because you're spreading the good word, you know, like the other part that I left it out. But the other part of the neocon philosophy was that the peace through strength enabled us to spread democracy across the world.
Oh,
right.
Yeah. Right.
OK.
Right.
Which, you know, here, this is how you should govern yourself. Have fun with that, you know. But if you put that in the context of a social conservative, well, fundamentalists in America are generally evangelical in their outlook. So, yeah, hell yeah. Send plenty of our boys out there to spread the good word. Send them Christian boys out there to do their job. Right?
Yeah.
And it's an easy sell to the fiscal hawks because the private sector's winning out.
Yeah.
Exactly what you want to happen is happening. The private sector has gleaned a military outlook, an impersonal military outlook on how they need to do business, right?
Right, right.
So everybody's making money. Fiscal conservatives are good with that too. And then the fiscal conservatives are able to sell the private sector does everything better to the social conservatives, because one of the core tenets of Christianity that stayed over into American philosophy is the harder you work, the more you get out of it.
Right.
So if you're a fundamentalist person who's a Republican and you have fiscal conservative that you're voting for, who's telling you this is all about individualism and this is all about being rewarded for the hard work you're putting in.
Right.
Because that's what prophets are. God smiling on you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right?
Of course.
Well, somebody kicked out a leg. I think they're especially vulnerable this year. I really do. More so maybe than I've ever seen them. I thought that maybe Bush was going to be their last president because Obama was so much better than him. I mean, he wasn't a perfect president, but he was so much better than anything the Republicans had fielded since before Reagan, you know. And there was a simmering of unrest. There's been a simmering of unrest in this country for about 10 years now, you know. I really thought that there, and when Trump ran, I thought, man, there's no way that dude's going to win. George W. Bush is going to be the last Republican president because that party's going to break up because of what that guy's doing to him. But he won, and he prolonged it. But maybe it ended up being for the best.
You know, it's funny because when – so I live in the UK. I'm Irish. Brexit has happened. My girlfriend is from Poland. I'm very personally affected by Brexit, you know. And Brexit and Trump happened so interlinked that they felt like the same thing. And by the way, it is looking like a lot of actual connections, like literal connections rather than just thematic connections at this point, you know. There's you know, a lot of players are involved in both of those dirty deeds. But anyway, if you had said to me in late 2016, maybe some of this is all for the best, I would have been like, get the fuck out of my face, don't talk to me about that.
I was losing my mind after
But it's funny, isn't it, because people are so aware and so mobilized, and I talk about norms all the time because I do think that we need to have rules that people have to follow, rather than norms that people can say, well, I don't want to follow that one, and everyone just, you know, stands around with their hands in their pockets. And I feel like maybe through all this misery, I can start to accept what you said, basically. I can start to accept it, that maybe some of it will have a positive outcome.
You know, it's funny, Connor. I'm going to bring up something you said, something that we've talked about twice now, about how you are of the opinion that maybe a further left party will spring out of the Democratic Party.
It's a hope. Yeah. You know, and I was taken to task for that a little bit on Twitter, actually, after that episode came out. And I fully respect the fact that people were like, hey, man, you're a little bit of a dreamer. I fully respect that position. But it's a hope that I have. You know, it's maybe it's not the number one most likely thing, but I could almost see it happening. But anyway, sorry. Talk about what that is. Let's talk about what that is.
I feel like it's likely. I feel like we need an episode to talk about it, though. I can give you just a, like, what's been on my mind about it, you know?
Yeah, and just in case. And just in case anybody who's listening, you know, has just tuned in the last couple of episodes, they missed that episode at the time or whatever, you know, give me a tight 90 seconds on
on. Well, right now we're at a point where we're at a point where 57% of Americans say they would definitely vote against a Republican. That's a stunning number. Definitely and against are really strong words. I've put that out a couple times already, but they really are. Yeah. Like pollsters pick words for a reason, man, you know. And those are very strong words. They give you other questions, and people chose to say, I would definitely vote against a Republican. That's a dying party, given that their age demographic is older, and given that it's becoming more and more obvious to the bulk of the American people, and I mean that they're not fair dealers, and they're really not into democracy.
Yeah.
If they die as a party, they may literally die as a party. Do you know what I mean? And if they do, and all that's left are the people that don't think like them anymore, the people on the far left of the Democratic Party will have to find a home.
Right. Yeah.
Because, and I should specify, far left, again, I think we've talked, I always like to say this because it's true, far left isn't universal health care. That's a majority supported. Far left isn't smart gun control. That's majority supported. So if the Democratic Party takes these majority supported positions and sweeps all over the country because it's majority supported, they're able to articulate them in a good way, you know, then the only option left is something further to the left.
Yeah.
Because the ones further to the right are literally dying off.
Yeah.
That's just my thought on that. I want to gel on it more before I give it a real treatment. I'm not even sure everything I said is absolutely what I believe yet, but I'm leaning towards those kinds of explanations. It feels to me like the right word. It feels to me like conservatism, political conservatism, might be on its last legs in this nation.
I mean, I've been thinking about the Overton window lately, and I guess part of what we're talking about there is the potential for the Overton window to shift a little bit, because it has shifted so far right in our lifetimes. The idea that it might not just correct, but that it might actually swing left is pretty exciting.
I think so too. Interestingly enough, I think the technological advances will enable that too. I think that the one technological advance that people aren't really paying attention to, they should, is 3D printing, fabrication, 3D fabrication.
Uh-huh.
If that can be mastered to the point of usability in all aspects, stuff really won't matter so much anymore.
You know, I just saw – no, go ahead. Sorry, dude. Yeah.
You know? No, because you can just print it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. There's a company – this means I'm going to have to try and find their name to put in the link to the show. But I'll put it on the website anyway. But there's a company that they've been working on, and they've released blueprints, and the blueprints are for things that you can make out of discarded plastic, and how to make machines that can make those things. And they don't have to be super fancy 3D printers. They're just machines that can machine stuff for you out of plastic. And they were saying the level of expertise that would be required is somebody who's handy around the house, or on the upper end of it would be your local handyman.
Really?
And it's really interesting. And the things they were making were kind of really cool and useful. But the point of it was they were saying this is the stuff that you throw away, or the stuff that you could pull out of the bin, out of your local dump. And that's an interesting change. Yeah.
I think that the technologies that are coming are going to usher in a political and economic change that we may or may not be ready for. But I'm not the only person that thinks that. So I do feel bright things on the horizon, though. I do. I do feel like the lie's been exposed for a lot of what's been going on in the world, not just my nation, the world. And you can only stand on a lie for so long.
Yeah,
it's just the truth. No, it's just the truth. You can only stand on a lie for so long. I don't think there'll be pitchforks in the street or anything, because I think that there is a generation of leaders that are coming up that are not going to take no for an answer from vested interests.
Yeah.
I don't know. Teddy did it. FDR did it.
I guess, at the risk of stating the obvious, and I apologize, one of the things that I think you and I have talked about, and that I think people talk a lot about, is the frustration of politicians who have never had to live with any form of want. And there's a generation of people, everybody calls them millennials, who are, you know, mocked by conservatives for liking avocado or whatever. But for any of us who are paying any attention at all, we can see they are struggling. And they are experiencing want. And when they become
amazing,
when they become leaders, then you have the potential for compassionate leaders who know what it's like to live paycheck to paycheck.
Yep. I think that counts for the X generation too, though. There are, I'd say, probably general guess 40% of us or so that, you know, did not grow up well off, that didn't have parents that took advantage of the baby boomer economy as well as others did, you know. Elizabeth Warren, she's an Xer, you know. Kamala Harris, she's an Xer. A lot of that is the product of that millennials really aren't of age to be in those types of leaderships, you know, those advanced leadership positions yet. I have a ton of hope because of the millennials, actually. I think that they're a fantastic generation. I'm kind of privileged to be able to watch them, frankly.
Yeah. Yeah, I find them really inspiring, actually. They kind of make me feel a little bit better.
You know what? We've been prattling for about 10 minutes about what we weren't going to talk about on this show. So, or not what we, not the show is the point. So maybe we should leave on that happy note. Millennials rock.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good one. So thus falls, hopefully, thus falls the tripod.
Thus falls the tripod. Yeah, absolutely. We can. I would rather end on that. I mean, for sure. The hope is there. When the lie is exposed and the stool comes collapsing down, something has to fill that gap. And generally, if you want to sit down, it's going to be something better, you know?
Well, thank you for sticking with us. I said that it was going to be a tough run. It wasn't as tough as I thought it was going to be because, Ben, you managed to bring a little bit of optimism every time. And now, at the end, I got to say, I'm feeling pretty energized about it. So I hope that you listening at home are. Yeah, I am, actually. No, seriously. That does give me a little bit of hope. I live in the UK. I'm despairing at a lot of what's happening at the moment. And a part of the problem is that there isn't a Mueller-like investigation, and there should be. But watching things unfold and watching lies come to light makes me hope that that might just catch on.
I think it will. I feel like we're in a place, this is so weird to say, but I feel like we're in a place where America might save the world one more time.
I mean, look, yeah. Okay.
I know that's crazy. I know it is. Okay. Look, I know that's crazy. I know America didn't technically save the world, you know, but that's the myth. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And yeah. I'm not downplaying, you know, America's importance in,
no, I
a friend of mine is married to a Russian, right?
Yeah. Okay.
And, years and years ago when they first met, he's a big history guy, huge history guy. And, three of us were taking a walk in the park. It was like the second time I met her. And I think we passed a monument actually for soldiers who had died in the Second World War. And he mentioned something about the Second World War. And she said, well, you know, it's called the Great Patriotic War because Russia won that war to save the world. So anyway, there we go.
Well, you know what? They saved their side of the world. They really did. They absolutely did save their side of the world. That's the truth. I mean, the world was bifurcated at the time, you know?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Like, they were never going to beat Russia in that in that setting. Yeah. Like, it was never going to – yeah. Never, but, you know, it was an incredible sacrifice. I mean, whatever about Russia now and whatever about the things Russia has become and Russia's incredibly bloody and troubled history, that's one they – that's a hit they took for the team in a big way.
Tell you what, that war could not have been won without them.
No, or at least not in the way it was, or not in the time frame that it was.
Agreed. Yeah, I'll buy that. So okay, not save the world, but lead the way. How about that? Lead the way.
Yeah. Be an example because we do. We look to America. We do. I'm interested in American politics because I have to be, because they will affect my life, whether I like it or not.
Okay, let me give you – you know what, folks? We're going to go a little long today because I want to tell you what's funny about that. You say that, right? And when you say that to me, as an American, I take a personal responsibility to that. Does that make sense?
It does.
And I feel like I'm not the only American that would take that kind of personal responsibility.
That's a good thought.
You know, like, that's kind of how we do here. and not because of the lie, the Republican lie of personal responsibility. That's not what I'm talking about, you know? But like, I think that because we're a nation founded on an idea rather than a people, we take personal responsibility for what our nation does rather than what our people do. Does that make sense?
It does.
I don't mean individual people, you know, than what we do as a people. We take a responsibility as a nation, like personal responsibility.
That's a good thought. Yeah, I like that.
That's my thought. I don't know that that's absolutely something. I can't be in everyone else's heads, you know. But I know that the veterans that I talk to take personal responsibility for that stuff. That may not be the best example. And I know that some of the civilians I talk to feel the same way about things, you know. I think that's why it's easy for an American to get angry that they think maybe we're sending too much money to country X or something, you know. Why is it my personal responsibility to help country X? Right? I mean, it can be expressed negatively, too, is what I'm saying.
Yeah. But the positive side of it, actually, you know, even anecdotally, I can remember so many interactions with Americans where I experienced that positive thing, actually. So that's a hopeful thought.
We're generally hopeful people.
Yeah, I think that's one of my favorite things about Americans is I love America's willingness to engage in hyperbole. I love that. because I really enjoy hyperbole. I enjoy enthusiasm, and I'm from a country where there's a certain reserve. There's a certain, you know, you don't want to be like, you think you're too good for me. That's a very Irish attitude. And I've always liked America's attitude of like, well, you know, what if we turned it up one higher? You know, I like that.
This one goes to 11, baby. Why do you think all movies have happy endings?
I like a happy ending. That's why we're doing this show, man.
That's right. That is why we're doing this show. And on that, we should end. We've been blathering on to these poor folks for far too long, I think.
Ah, we've gone like 3 minutes long. They can handle it.
Oh, really? Oh, we rock.
Exactly. All right, folks. Once again, thank you so much for listening. Tell your friends. If you use iTunes, which I think a lot of people don't, but, you know, okay. If you do. Yeah. If you happen to use iTunes, it is weird how effective it will be if you leave a review for us. It is absurd how much that one aggregator affects everything else. Even people who aren't using iTunes are affected by the review you leave if you use iTunes. So if you can, do it. And if you can't, that's okay. Just keep listening.
For sure. We love that you listen. And we love doing this show for you guys. We wanted to say that before we go. We love doing it. And we love that you guys like it. It's just the best thing ever.
Yeah, it really is. It's a real privilege, actually. All right, folks, let's say good night.
Good night, everybody.
One more thing. Elizabeth Warren is not so much a Gen Xer. She's actually 69. Sorry about that.